It's the Full 48. Howard Beck, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. The restart rolls on. The Lakers have clinched the top seed in the West. The Clippers are kind of all over the map. The Grizzlies are fading fast. Eighth seed's up for grabs in the West. The Suns are kind of fun suddenly. And there's a lot to talk about. My guest today is in the bubble. In fact, I believe he's the only person in the bubble who needed two rooms, one for himself and one for all of his Paul Mitchell products. Chris Mannix, senior NBA writer, or senior writer, not NBA, senior writer, senior something for SI and DAZN and a bunch of other stuff. Mannix, what's going on?
It's Crew Americana, Beck, is the hair product of choice. And it's expensive, and I stocked up on probably twice as much as I need coming into this bubble. In fact, it's funny, like, I try to dress somewhat normally, but I've been pretty much sweatpants, t-shirt throughout this entire process. Like, jeans out. I wore, like, some, you know, khaki shorts for the first couple of days, then said screw it. So I've been pretty dressed down throughout this experience.
But the hair still looks great, and that's what's important.
I think what's important is the hair stays on the head, so I also do my stuff there.
You have not been making regular stops in the with the NBA barber?
I made one stop early on. You know what's funny, and I'll throw him under the bus here. I don't know how many times Mark Spears has been to the barber, like, but it feels like every day he's in there. Like he's in there all the time, getting a trim there. And it's not like he's got this like shaggy mane on his head, but he's in there a lot getting himself cleaned up. So Mark Spears keeping it tight here in the bubble.
Nice. That's good to hear. It's encouraging. It's important. It's important to keep it tight in the bubble. I, on the other hand, outside the bubble and in Brooklyn, still have not had a haircut in 5 months, which I think is the longest I've gone in my entire life. So
just buzz it off, man. Just buzz it. Let it go.
I'm afraid, man. I'm afraid. It may never come back.
You're not Samson, okay? It'll come back at some point. Your powers of podcasting will not disappear if you shave your head.
That is my concern. Also, my power to simply regrow the hair that I still have. You've been in the bubble for what, like 3 weeks now? Has it been four?
About three plus weeks. I think we're into the fourth week.
Give me the best thing, and not necessarily from a personal standpoint, but just as a reporter being there. What's the best thing so far about the experience? What's the worst thing so far? What's the new normal?
Well, the best thing is the access. I wrote this recently, but it's still true. This is like a NBA writer's fantasy camp because, you know, a lot of people choose to go to games, the scrimmages, the seating games. I don't. I spend a lot of my time in the Coronado Springs lobby where you have anywhere from 4 to 5 practices a day going on. And you know, Howard, that, you know, when you want to see a specific team, you either have to wait for them to come through your home market or you hop on a plane, you go through all that process to get down there and spend a couple of days with them. I'll spend my morning covering Portland. I'll spend my early afternoon with the Lakers. I'll spend late afternoon with the Bucks, and I'll finish the day with the Rockets. Like, it's the kind of access that you could never even dream of happening. It is like summer league, except the players are the real thing, you know, where you can see them and be around them and watch ends of practices and get access to certain players. That, to me, has been by far and away the best things. I mean, there are little things to nitpick with. I mean, you know, people quibble about the food and the weather down in Florida, but for this kind of access, I'll take it. I mean, it's been nothing but a overwhelmingly positive experience for me.
You know, one of the things that we were all curious about when they were setting this up, of course, was that, you know, with no fans in the arena and all these seats available, then the reporters who were in the bubble, as you are, you're going to be getting the kind of proximity to the court that we used to have once upon a time, right? Like, you know, when you and I first started covering this league, and certainly when I did, we were always either sideline or baseline court level. And the advantage of that is you pick up more. Interactions between players, and not even just trash talk, like expressions, just how physical it gets sometimes, and when things are heating up between two players. Sometimes hearing interactions between coaches and players, refs and players, there's a lot you pick up. And then we've lost all that over the years as the NBA has wanted to cash in on those seats, understandably, and we've gotten moved further away. There's no fans there, so there's nothing to really drown out anything. I know they're pumping in some noise. I don't know what's just on TV versus what you're hearing in the arena. So I know you're saying you're not going to a lot of them, but when you're there, Are you picking up a lot more, or are they messing with the noise even internally just to kind of keep the sounds from traveling even for you who are in the arena?
No, you're picking up a lot more, and I think from watching some of the games on TV and, of course, being at a bunch of them, the TV experience emphasizes the crowd noise more than the in-arena experience. In arena, you are still getting kind of the organ music, the hip-hop music they play on offensive possessions. I mean, all the stuff that comes with a normal NBA game. The crowd noise, I think, is more felt from the television viewer experience than it is in the arena. So it certainly presents the opportunity to pick up and hear different things. And being, like, I'll give an example. Like, I was at the Raptors Magic game this week, and you know, I'm watching Kyle Lowry, you know, one of the most competitive guys I think we've both ever covered, like an ultra-competitive guy. And just, you know, sitting courtside, I can pick up on, you know, just how intense he is. Even in a game his team leads by double digits, he's trash-talking Evan Fournier on the free throw line when his team's up 16. His team's up double digits with like 3 minutes to go, and he's underneath the rim battling Nikola Vucevic for an offensive rebound. These are kind of the little things that I don't think I would pick up on from what's become the normal seats for media that I can add to the writing experience. I included both those things in my column about the Raptors, and I think that adds real value. So I understand why the NBA's taken the seats away from us. They're premium seats, and they're never coming back, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, this kind of opportunity, you know, gives you a real chance to see how players are interacting, to see, you know, kind of how coaches are instructing players on the sideline too. I mean, I hear a lot of what a coach will say to a player, whether it's about a specific player, where he wants to go with it. So there's a lot you can glean being in that courtside position.
And this is why when we occasionally bring it up, I know fans always, you know, the second we talk about our seating over the years, it's like, oh, you guys are just, you know, whining and complaining. You have to go to the games for free, blah, blah, blah. No, folks, it truly, truly, truly is about how you see the game, how you experience it, and then how we convey that to you, the fans, the readers, because we did, as Chris, as you just listed off all of these observations, the further you get, the less of that you see and can pick up on, and it informs your reporting, and it gives you a different sense of the game and how players are carrying themselves, the emotions of it, the physicality, all of it. So, you know, yeah, it was cool to sit close, but not just because it was fun. I mean, we're doing a job. It's the observation. Our whole job is about observation, or a lot of it.
Yeah, and look, even like, I mean, God, it's weird that the Knicks were one of the last teams to hold on to those seats, but they were. I mean, they had really good seats for courtside media for a long time. And, you know, sitting there, you know, along that, you know, the baseline of the visiting bench, you picked up a lot. And it led to, I think, a lot of good notes and nuggets and things you include in copy for people to read. And, you know, frankly, at Madison Square Garden, I wasn't there at all this past season because I see no point in going there. Not just because the Knicks are bad, but because they put you effectively in the rafters. So there's not a lot you gain by being in the building watching a game. And that's not just unfortunate for us. It's unfortunate for someone that might want to learn something about the game and what we're writing.
Yeah, absolutely. One other thought on the arenas in the bubble. So the Lakers did a really cool thing. Lawrence Tanter, who in my mind still number one best PA announcer in the NBA. I'm a little biased because I spent my first 7 years covering the Lakers as an NBA writer. LT's the best, and they had him record all the intros so that, like, he's, you know, they've got a bunch of guys from various teams who are doing all of the teams, all the games, but his is pre-recorded from there. Aside from that, though, is there anything that's being done? Like, all right, we see, you know, if it's a Laker home game, all right, we see a bunch of Laker, you know, banners and whatever, video banners and that kind of stuff. And of course, the virtual crowd and stuff. When you're at a game, is there anything else that teams are doing? And is there any sense when you're watching a Laker home game, a Bucks home game, a Sixers home game in the bubble, that it is truly their game? Or does this just, is like, no matter what they do, does it just feel like, yeah, this is just a weird neutral court game?
No, everything that can possibly be done to give a team a quote home court advantage is being done, from the opening introductions to your point. I mean, Lawrence Tanter did it. I mean, I think most of the teams are doing it with their home PA man introduced in the starting lineup. So Eddie Palladino from Boston did the Celtics starting lineups. I was at The Magic were technically the home game against the Raptors. They had their home announcer doing it. And, you know, whether it's having kind of the defense drumbeat happen when there's a key defensive possession for the home team, or the graphics and the sound effects and the virtual fans up there on those big screens that flank the floor, it's all meant to enhance that home court experience. Now, there's only so much you can do.
Yeah.
Like, you, the virtual fans is a little bizarre, in part because they can't even sell out the virtual fan seats because, for whatever reason, there's always at least a quarter of them that are empty, and some of these virtual fans need to remember they're always on camera. You know, be careful what you're doing in those positions.
What's the worst thing you've
seen?
I've
seen a lot of nose picking. I have. It's it's nothing bad, but I've seen nose picking. And look, it has been cool, you know, seeing Paul Pierce as a virtual fan at a Celtic game was pretty cool. Like, seeing, you know, yeah, LeBron having his I Promise School as virtual fans is an excellent idea. So there's been some cool parts to it, but, I mean, there's not any noise emanating from that. You see them, like, on free throws, right? The virtual fans that are positioned along the baseline, they stand up and wave like fans would do in a traditional game, try to distract the free throw shooter, but I'm not sure exactly how much distracting that's going to be. So that's a long way of saying, like, they do different things. Like, you are, they try to make as much of a home court experience you can get, but with nobody in the building, there's only so much you can do.
Yeah, so there really is no, like, whatever they've done, you can't say there's a home court advantage.
No. I mean,
yeah.
No. I mean, I don't see LeBron James getting rattled by a defense drumbeat playing the Clippers in. It's unbelievably weird at times. Like the opener, for example. I was at the Laker Clipper game in the opener, and, you know, LeBron made what I thought was one of the great defensive stands of the season, right? Where he bottles up Kawhi Leonard and then switches out on Paul George. He takes top 15 players and locks them up defensively.
Yeah.
And ordinarily, at a Laker game, like, that would draw enormous roars from a crowd. This was nothing. It was just like, all right, am I watching a scrimmage here? You don't get the feel that you're watching a consequential moment, and it becomes magnified when you're one of the media covering it, because you're not hearing the announcer, right? Like, an announcer can, like a Mike Breen, can say, "What a great play by LeBron," and kind of make you feel a little bit of the moment. Sitting there, we're kind of like, all right, that just happened. Oh, the Lakers just won, and that was a meaningful game. And what just happened there? So that part of it is very strange. But no, there's no home court advantage whatsoever. It's neutral site all the way around.
Yeah. And that's going to be something that we all just kind of have to get used to. And the players, I think, probably are already getting used to, Chris. I mean, if the one thing that I would really say has stood out in the first whatever week of seeding games is that the intensity level seems to be there despite not having the crowd. You know, there's, you know, and that can work both ways too, right? Like, there are a lot of guys who especially the stars, who love being on the road. They love the hostile environment. They say that all the time, and they're pumped up by that. And it can go either way. But all right, so that, the atmosphere is not going to do it. That's not going to what is going to charge these guys up. But to your point, LeBron going all out on that play, like, sitting at home on my couch, I'm practically like yelling at the screen, like, "Wow, that was amazing." They're, by and large, quality of play maybe has a little bit of fine tuning to do, but the intensity level feels like it's there. And, you know, like, I think that's a good sign that they've adapted quickly to a very different and bizarre environment.
No, the intensity level is definitely there. The defense is not, but I think that's a byproduct of conditioning. And I think that's going to get better as it comes around. I mean, there's nothing you can do to replicate a training camp or getting into game shape. No amount of, you know, bike rides on a Peloton or, you know, pick up whatever you were doing during a pandemic can get you in that kind of shape. So that's not all that surprising. What has surprised me is the sharpness of how teams have played with offensively. I mean, there have been some teams that have struggled, like the Lakers. Their perimeter shooting has been bad for most of the restart. But by and large, teams have been better at perimeter shooting, at three-point shooting, than I thought they were going to be. I thought there would be a skills regression coming into this, and there really hasn't been. And I give the players a lot of credit for that, teams a lot of credit for that, for, you know, kind of emphasizing this from the moment they were able to get their hands on these guys and getting them up until this point. So with the quality of play being as good as it's been now, I think it foreshadows it's a good sign for the NBA that when you get to the playoffs, yeah, that you can expect the quality to only get better.
And I got to do a mea culpa on this one. I thought for sure, and it wasn't because I had any lack of faith in coaches or players, but just 4.5 months away with gyms closed, difficulty getting to anything. A lot of guys having no access to baskets at all during the lockdown. I thought it would be messier to start off with. And maybe this speaks well to not just guys keeping themselves in shape and finding ways to stay in shape and in rhythm, but that maybe muscle memory wins out. You know, maybe 4.5 months, you get back, you get that ball. Even if you didn't touch a ball for 4.5 months, it gets back in your hands, you're in a gym, and boom, it comes back that quickly. Like maybe we're learning something about, you know, physiology and muscle memory here. So we mentioned the Lakers, and they I said at the top, they clinched number one seed in the West. LeBron crowed about it a little bit, which was a little odd, it feels like, for a guy who's won championships, but okay. I mean, so okay, great. They're the number one seed. We just talked about the fact there's no home court advantage. Does it mean anything? And in fact, to the contrary, some people have pointed out, is this actually a disadvantage? Because the eighth seed might be Portland, a team that now that it's whole, and granted, Nurkic and Collins are still getting their legs back under them, but this isn't a team that, based on quality of roster, if not for the injuries during the season, would have ever been an eighth seed. They would have been maybe fourth or fifth. And here they are. They might be the Lakers' first round opponent. Is this actually going to potentially backfire?
It was a little strange to read the comments from LeBron about winning the conference. I mean, it's not like they have these, you know, Pacific Division champion banner raising ceremonies at Staples Center.
No.
But as far as that first round matchup, yeah, there's nothing the Lakers can do about it. You're not going to intentionally lose games to fall into that number two slot, but the circumstances, the way they've all played out, they could wind up with the toughest first round matchup, not just in the NBA, but maybe in NBA history. Like, I don't know that there would be a tougher number eight seed than the Portland Trailblazers would be coming into this. I mean, the Blazers, I mean, you mentioned Nurkic and Collins, and they've looked really good. I mean, Nurkic put up a big number on Houston the other night, though, you know, grabbing rebounds against Houston's like, you know, Billy Madison grabbing rebounds on the playground. Like, it's just, you know, I watched Brooke Lopez do it, and then Nurkic did it as well. So, you know, take that into account. But Nurkic has been very good. Collins has been solid out there. And Carmelo, of all people, is coming around a little bit. He's still, you know, there still are moments. I mean, the Boston game, Carmelo reverted a lot to mid-range Melo and contested shot Melo, and those things certainly worry you. And defensively, you know, he's just not able to stay with some of the quicker small forwards in today's game, but he still is a shot maker. And they have, as you saw at the end of one of those recent games, was the Portland game, or not the Portland game, but whoever they beat at the buzzer there. You know, they trust Carmelo. Like, they trust him, yeah, in those types of situations to have the ball in his hand and make big shots. So if you're the Lakers, you know, you're happy about getting that number one seed, but you've got to be really concerned about that number eight seed. I've seen people out there say, oh, don't worry about it. The Blazers are good, but they're not that good. LeBron, Anthony Davis, they're so much better. And that may play itself out. But while the Milwaukee Bucks might not play a consequential basketball game until like September, the Lakers, as soon as that postseason starts, they're going to be in for it. I mean, Damian Lillard is as dangerous as any scorer in the NBA right now. McCollum is excellent. And you're talking about matching up with those guys with the most depleted backcourt you can possibly have. I mean, I expect Rondo, yeah, to beat that 6 to 8 week time frame because he's Rondo and he might be the toughest player when it comes to playing through pain and injury that I've ever covered. But you don't have Avery Bradley. You're playing Deion Waiters and J.R. Smith legitimate minutes. That's got to be a concern going up against that backcourt. To me, it comes down to how well Melo can perform against LeBron in that particular matchup. And man, Howard, like, what a storyline it would be. You know, Carmelo Anthony, in maybe his last shot at doing something substantial, going up against his close friend, but also his nemesis, the guy that has achieved more in his career team-wise than Carmelo ever has. I mean, that, you know, that would be a series I'd want to cover from start to finish.
No, it is among the best and most unexpected storylines that we could have anticipated, right? Like, this is not, and especially when you look back, you know, just to the start of this season, Carmelo's not even on a roster. You think his career might be over. The whole league has passed on him multiple times after, you know, being, you know, the short stint with Houston, traded to Chicago, waived by Chicago. Everybody's just kind of lost interest, not sure if he fits, not sure if he's willing to play a role, all these things. And so, like, this has been amazing, and it's been awesome watching Carmelo kind of revive himself and once again kind of revise his image and show a lot of the league and maybe, you know, as the Blazers are all saying, show the media, whoever you want to show, that he still got something and that it was a mistake to write him off, which is great. Like, I love it. But if wherever this is going, if it is a first round matchup with LeBron, it is as it has always been, and as I wrote about a few years ago, like there's a very much like a mixed bag here, because they're really great friends, and that matchup will be phenomenal to watch one more time, Carmelo versus LeBron, maybe for the last time in meaningful games. But it's one that, yeah, as you allude to, LeBron's always had the upper hand there, and so it probably doesn't end well for the Blazers and for Melo. But who knows? Like, I think Carmelo won't necessarily tip that series, although let's face it, he could do again what he's just done the last few days. He could hit some big shots down the stretch of a critical game in a series. But I think it really is what you said, Chris. Lillard and McCollum are one of the most dangerous backcourts in the NBA, and the Lakers are depleted there, and having LeBron and AD is great. And yes, those guys will pound on the Blazers at the other end, no doubt. But those are games that can get away with get away from you. And no, I don't think that's the way that they would want to start off a long drive.
No, and Howard, these Laker defenders out there on social media, like, it's not just reporters that are pointing out that this matchup could be tough. Danny Green outright said it, like, that, you know, this is not a matchup, and I'm paraphrasing, but this is not a matchup that we'd be looking forward to against Portland. And I'd push back a little bit on what you said about Carmelo not tipping that series. I think he might. Like, you can expect Lillard and McCollum to be great. You can expect LeBron and Davis to be great. You know, when I watched Anthony against Boston, he couldn't stay with Jason Tatum at all. Jason Tatum lit him up in that game. Carmelo's ability to play small forward and allow the Blazers to play big with Collins and Nurkic, presumably going up against AD and the combination of Dwight Howard and JaVale McGee, That to me is a difference-making, you know, type of situation there. If he can provide any kind of, you know, even average defense in that series, it could make the difference. If he shoots 42% instead of 29%, that could make a difference. There are things I can count on in a series. I can count on Lillard being awesome. I can count on McCollum being just a cut below that. I can count on LeBron and AD doing their things. I don't know what I can count on with Carmelo Anthony. That's why if I'd be more confident in the Blazers' ability to pull off an upset if Trevor Ariza was here. I mean, Trevor Ariza is that kind of versatile defensive wing that would be incredibly valuable in a player in a series like that. With him gone, the pressure is even more significant on Carmelo, and how he delivers in a series like that, I think, could tip the balance one way or the other.
No, it's certainly possible. And as I say, look, he's a great clutch shooter, and having that outlet for that, you know, for Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum, knowing that they've got another guy who's a shot maker, and in critical situations, that is huge. And yeah, listen, you know, a game five or something where he makes a couple big shots down the stretch, It's plausible. Let's switch to the other LA team. I know you had Nick Wright on your podcast, The Crossover, recently, and Nick has been pounding the last couple of days the idea that the Clippers are in trouble. And there's a case to be made. They're 1-2. They lost to the Suns. Pat Beverly's got a calf injury now. Lou Will just got back from quarantine. Marcus Morris is struggling. Montrezl Harrell still not back yet. I mean, I still feel like the Clippers, look, there's no question, and even Nick can't argue this, when the Clippers are whole, they've got better 3-8 talent than the Lakers do. They may have the best 3-8 in the league. Their depth is fantastic. That doesn't mean anything if the depth isn't there, of course, or if they don't get a chance to get a rhythm because it's been such a choppy couple of weeks. ESPN, their playoff odds, Clippers have a 10% chance right now to win the title, behind the Bucks at almost 50% and the Lakers at about 19%. Are the Clippers in trouble right now?
I have my concerns about the Clippers, and I've expressed this both on my podcast, other interviews. My concern is, it touches on what you said there. that while they do have one of the most talented rosters in the NBA and two elite stars, including one highly proven playoff performer in Kawhi, they have had no continuity since this restart first happened. Whether it's, you know, being bit by the COVID bug, family tragedies that have afflicted several members of that team, the Lou Williams fiasco, they have not had this group together for more than like a day or two during this whole experience, dating back to late June, early July, when the team started reporting back to facility. I mean, they just got their starting center back just a few days ago or a week ago now in Zubac, and he's admitted that he's nowhere near in the right shape to be, you know, playing at a high level. I think all that matters. I think the teams that have been together throughout this, and Oklahoma City's an example of that, a team that was very careful and has not been afflicted by various things. Utah had to deal with their stuff early on, but they've, you know, have been able to keep their team intact. I think all that matters in this context. So to me, the Clippers, you can look as good as you want on paper, but these injuries that you're talking about, the hamstring strains, this is all part, it's not an accident. This is all part of being slow to come back and not having the right time to condition your team and get them in the right shape. I mean, you can't expect Montrezl Harrell, Lou Williams, Zubac to be themselves at any point in the next couple of weeks. It's going to take them at least a couple of weeks, maybe more, to get up to speed. And at that time, you'll be in the postseason. So I think the Clippers, weirdly enough, I think the Clippers, if they can survive the first round, I think they've got a great chance of getting to the finals. Like, I think I'm more, put it another way, I'm more worried about the Clippers losing in the first round than I am them losing to the Lakers in a conference finals. Because this is just, they're just not the same team. They're going to progressively get back to being the same team, but early on in this postseason, they're going to face a tough matchup, whether it's Oklahoma City or Dallas or somebody else. And I'd be concerned if I was the Clippers, seeing what my team looks like right now.
And I would just say this, Chris. It's not just that they've had a choppy run the last couple of weeks since getting to the bubble. They had a choppy season because, you know, Paul George recovering from the shoulder surgeries, Kawhi's load management, those two barely having any time together on the court during the season. Remember, I think it was in January where Montrezl Harrell actually, like, popped off post-game one day basically saying, like, this isn't the same team and we can't just assume anything. Like, remember, that was a team that won 48 games without any stars. The stars arrive and now they're trying to figure out their identity all over again. Like, we really, like, for all as good as they look on paper, and I've been one who's from last October was saying I thought the Clippers should be the favorite, not by a ton, but I thought better on paper and certainly, as I say, better depth. But they really, like, that team only exists in concept, I feel like. Because we really haven't seen them together long enough, cohesive enough for a long enough run to make that a reality. And I agree with you. Yeah, like they got to survive the first round first. But if they do, then maybe they've got a rhythm and they've got their health and they can make a long run. But
two things there. One is they're going to be the ultimate test of can you flip the switch, right? Because they've got the talent. It's all there now in Orlando, and can they just flip a switch and become the great team that they look like on paper? The other question mark is Paul George. I mean, we know what Kawhi is capable of doing in the postseason. Paul's been one of the few bright spots of the Clippers during this restart. He's making shots all over the place, but you know, Paul doesn't have a great history when it comes to the postseason. I mean, his teams came up short in Indiana in the conference finals. Obviously, last season in Oklahoma City ended poorly for them in the first round. He's got a lot to prove in a postseason like this. So I don't look at the Clippers. I mean, I understand their talent, but I don't look at them as being this kind of team that'll just march all the way to the conference finals and play the Lakers. They've got some stuff to overcome before they get there.
Yeah, agreed. In Paul George's defense, he was pretty young and just becoming a star during those conference finals runs in Indiana, and they were facing the Heat, I think, both times.
And there's no question about that. I mean, that nobody expected that those Pacers teams to beat that Heat team. I mean, that was the Heat at their peak, to use a phrase there. However, last season, I think you can put some on Paul George and that team. You know, when you go up against the Blazers in the first round, you should be expected to perform and to win, and that didn't happen. So he's got to show that he can rise to that Kawhi-like level in this playoff.
The Suns. The Suns were fun. That Devin Booker shot was phenomenal. I leaped off the couch for that one. That was really cool. That was really fun. Is this just a feel-good story in this weird bubble season and we'll forget about it and the Suns will go back to just being the Suns? Or is this the start of something? Are we seeing a glimmer of an actual respectable team, a relevant team starting to emerge after obviously a very long drought?
Oh, no, I think we're seeing the start of something in Phoenix. I don't know if it ends in a playoff spot, great. Even if it doesn't, I think the Suns have accomplished something significant down here, playing in big games, meaningful games, and giving their stars a taste, their young stars a taste of the playoff race. There are two reasons that I think that Phoenix, this is a trend in the right direction for Phoenix. One, they're a functional organization now. I mean, for the last 5 or 6 years, I mean, basically the entirety of Devin Booker's tenure in Phoenix, they've just been, you know, one change after another, new coach. I mean, how many coaches Devin Booker had? Like 7? I mean, it's been
too many.
It's been wild. Like, there's been no, it's not been a functional situation in Phoenix. Now it is. They're established in the front office. James Jones is there. They're established in the coaching box. Monty Williams has solidified that position. They've built something with their backcourt. Ricky Rubio is an ideal fit alongside Devin Booker, a pass-first point guard who takes the playmaking responsibilities off him. So they have the pieces to start building this thing. Now, we can debate the DeAndre Ayton pick, and I certainly wonder what they'd look like if they had Luka Doncic in that spot. But Ayton, I think, is going to be a good player, maybe just not a great player in the NBA. And the other big story coming out of this has been Booker. You know, and Suns fans, and I hear from them on social media, they get mad when I, you know, position Booker up until this point as a guy that's been viewed as just a scorer, as something of empty calories. But that's been a perception amongst some league types. I don't know if you've heard it or not, but I mean, that's something that I've...
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that often from people in the league, that like, you put Devin Booker in a winning situation and he's not going to be that type of player. Maybe it's unfair, but that's what that perception has been. And Booker, in this restart, has, you know, started to change that perception. By the way, that perception, it gained some momentum in my mind when the coaches didn't vote Devin Booker on the All-Star team. Like, this was the coaches' vote. Like, the reserves were voted by the coaches, and they put guys like Brandon Ingram and even, like, Russell Westbrook was on that team, Chris Paul. Like, they put guys on the roster that were having an inferior season to Devin Booker. So you can't just say it's the media that's positioning Devin Booker like this. But regardless, Devin Booker, the way he's played, not just with that game-winning shot, but how he's played in this entire restart, is showing that he can be a franchise player, that he can be the number one guy, a building block on a playoff team, and something you can build around for the future.
Yeah, and if Ayton keeps making the kind of progress he's making, and if they have some stability finally, and Monty Williams is a great coach, I looked it up, it is 5 coaches in 5 years for Devin Booker. You know, continuity matters, having a plan matters, getting good talent around you matters, having a competent point guard matters. And so in Devin Booker's defense, like, Rubio's the first real frontline point guard he's had.
He was playing point guard. Devin was playing point guard the last couple of years. So
right.
I don't blame him. And I had this conversation with an assistant GM, as I'm going to try to write something about him in the coming days. Like, this assistant GM has always believed in him, and he's pointed specifically to what we're just talking about, the lack of a point guard and the dysfunctional situation. Young players do not grow in those types of situations. In fact, young players can regress in those types of situations. And Devin Booker seems to have fought his way through those early issues and is now coming out on the other side looking like a high-level player.
One of the things one of the defenses for the NBA doing the format this way and inviting non-playoff teams to try to play in and everything was something like this, right? Like, if you're a young team like the Suns and you've got a young star like Devin Booker and you're trying to cultivate, you're trying to establish an identity and winning values, being, even right now, if they don't make the playoffs, and they probably still won't, but these are like playoff games for them, and playing meaningful games, especially toward the end of a season, even if it's the end of a season in August, that helps. And I have no doubt Monty Williams and that organization are thrilled that they're getting meaningful games that feel like they have real stakes to help these young players grow. So there's the upside. The downside is we have seen a bunch of injuries. My God, the poor Orlando Magic have, you know, thoughts with Jonathan Isaac, who came on this podcast a couple months ago. Aaron Gordon has a hamstring strain with the Magic. Like, there's, you know, there were always going to be risks in bringing 22 teams instead of 16. But this is good for the Suns, Chris. It's good for a couple other teams. I pointed out on Twitter this morning, but there's also the absurdity of the fact that the Wizards are now behind the Charlotte Hornets in the standings. The Wizards are in the bubble. The Hornets were not in the bubble, or were not invited, and yet the Wizards could finish below them in this. Like, this, so there's an absurdity too. And yet, again, back to the West, this is a fun race. You know, we thought New Orleans would be in it. They've kind of faded, but Portland is really emerging, and the Suns are having this nice run. And it's made the case for, as some people have said, maybe this should be the way, not an original idea, but to have some sort of play-in tournament or have some different kind of way of getting the eighth seed. A bunch of stuff there. Start anywhere. Does this justify the NBA bringing 22 teams, or does the Wizards underscore how absurd it was? Where are we on just the format and what this says for today and maybe for the future?
Well, I think it first should be said that the biggest reason there are 22 teams in the bubble is money, because owners who would be shouldering the cost in part for this bubble experience wanted their teams to be a part of it. I'm not convinced that every team in the bubble coming into this necessarily wanted to be here, but owners did, and money talks. And if they were putting up money as part of their responsibilities to the NBA, they wanted their teams to be a part of it. All that being said, I am wholeheartedly in favor of adopting this play-in stuff full time. It has changed the complexion of the Western Conference playoff race. Putting aside what's happening in the East, and it's the Wizards, but it's kind of the zombie Wizards because it's no Bradley Beal and it's no Davis Bertans, and of course John Wall is missing. It's been great watching six teams duke it out for that final playoff spot. It's, you know, 5.5 really, because I don't know what Memphis is going to look like by the time this is all over. They keep losing guys left and right. But San Antonio has been surprising early on. They won their first couple of games. Phoenix, we talked about. You know, Sacramento has been a debacle, but, you know, that's a different conversation. But I think this can only be a positive for the final month plus of every NBA regular season going forward. How many times, Howard, have we looked at the end of a regular season as being just so inconsequential? Teams playing out the string. Teams that are 3-4 games back having nothing really to play for. Now, if you're a team in the West, in say the Western Conference, and you can see a pathway to getting within 4 games the number 8 seed, you play hard all the way to the end. You don't rest guys. You don't look at... You don't try to, you know, to play for next season. You push all the way through, and I love that. I think that makes it incredibly competitive. And you give a team like a Portland, which may be ravaged by injury all season long, a chance to get into the playoffs once they get healthy at the end of it. And I think for the West, I mean, think about the West next year. Who's the worst team in the Western Conference next year? Is it Minnesota? Maybe. Yeah. But the Timberwolves will be better. I mean, it might be Minnesota. Is it Sacramento?
It's going to be. It's tough to peg because we have so many teams that are seemingly on the rise. I mean, what if Pop retires and the Spurs, you know, tear it down? Like, that's a possibility, right? I mean, I thought the Kings were a team on the rise. And now as I'm looking at teams that would be competing for the worst record next year with the Warriors back to being the Warriors, it could be Kings and Timberwolves. I hate to say it. And I like some of the Kings
But they'll get better. But, like, the Kings are down Marvin Bagley. Like, that'll... They'll get a guy maybe in the draft if they don't screw that up.
You're right. No, the Kings should not be at the bottom. Like, it's probably the Timberwolves by default. But like and maybe if a Spurs rebuild happens or something. But it's like I'm looking at this. The Grizzlies are on the rise. Like, I don't know if it's possible for 15 of 16 teams to be simultaneously on the rise. But
The Timberwolves. You're talking about a team with Karl Anthony Towns, an all NBA talent, D'Angelo Russell, an All Star, a likely top 5 draft pick. Like, they're going to be getting better. Like, they're going to be making progress next year. I mean, I think the Western Conference, I don't think I've ever seen a conference where you can make, you might be able to make an argument that the very worst team in the Western Conference could be the 8th seed in the Eastern Conference. Like, the bottom of it could be conceivably the 8th seed in the East. Like, that's how good the West is going to be next year. Which brings me to my point, which brings me back to the point of, like, I think for next year, you want to give those teams, you know, 9 through 12, something to play for. Even 9 through 15, something to play for. A chance to jockey to get within a half game of that, or a couple of games of that number eight seed, and get into a play-in tournament. And we haven't even gotten to the play-in tournament, but like, I think it's going to be awesome. Like, I'm kind of hoping Memphis isn't a part of it now, because I don't think the Grizzlies stand a chance with the roster they have.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at New Orleans versus Portland in a play-in situation, oh, sign me up. That's like another, you know, quality first round matchup that we're getting for free.
Yeah, no, that would be a blast. And this is like, neither Chris nor I should be mistaken for hating on the Grizzlies at all. But it's like, no Jaren Jackson Jr. Justice Winslow was already out. They're a young team. They're depleted. It would be more fun at this point, I think, for the average fan to see Blazers Pelicans in a mini series. And this is why it was such a mistake, I thought, and unfortunate that Adam Silver decided to package all these things together when he was trying to put through the midseason tournament and the play-in tournament and the reseeding and everything all at once. Some of these were easier than others, Chris. And I know that this is like almost feels like ancient history, like that all happened 10 years ago. But man, a play-in tournament, especially partially as an anti-tanking measure, partially as a preserve the quality of or restore the quality of basketball in late March and early April measure. Like, this just seems like such a no-brainer. And yes, we're seeing it play out right now. And not so much in the East, but in the West, this is great. Yeah, they should adopt this, some form of it, whatever it is. Just do something. Make it so that the teams that would normally be packing it in and pulling the plug on everybody and resting guys for the last 3 weeks of the season, give them incentive to keep playing down the stretch. It's just better for the game on every level. This should be an easy one.
And somebody brought this up, and I apologize not remembering who wrote it, but it, as part of that, you may want to, I mean, look, it's, we talked about it being unfair for the Lakers, you know, having to potentially face Portland in the first round. Do you give the number one seed then a chance to pick between the 7 and 8 seed? I mean, that might be a bridge too far and a little bit too goofy, but the downside of the situation we're describing, what could play out in the Western Conference, is that, you know, the number one seed that spent all season long getting to that spot may have to face a 8th seed juggernaut like the Blazers would be, as opposed to somebody that is more a traditional bottom seed in your bracket.
I'll say this too, as somebody who has never been completely convinced of doing the 1 through 16 format. I've got my doubts about it. Obviously, this was a place where they could have done it because there's no travel involved. So now it's easy to do it without worrying about all of the extra travel. Going in, I didn't think, nah, don't do that if you're just messing around with it and you're going to go back to the normal 1 through 8 in each conference when you get out of the bubble. But now I'm looking at it and like, the Nets are a zombie team. The Magic are a zombie team. So now you've got like two teams in the East that have no business being in the playoffs. Meanwhile, we've got multiple teams in the West scrapping for that 8th seed. All of a sudden, I got to say, I know I'm late to the party on this one as we're sitting on August 6th, but man, I'm kind of wishing we could just like jettison some of these teams and have the really good ones be in the playoffs, which start in a couple weeks here. But that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I don't worry too much about what we're seeing in the Eastern Conference long term. I mean, look, we're hopefully not going to have coronavirus part of our life beyond, you know, this current season. Like, the reason the Nets are a zombie team is because Spencer Dinwiddie backed out, DeAndre Jordan backed out, all because of coronavirus. You know, and Davis Bertans isn't here because, you know, Davis Bertans ain't screwing around with his contract next season. Bradley Beal is you know, allegedly injured, you know, enough to not play in this break. I think a lot of it's circumstance. I think, look, a healthy Nets team down here and a healthy Wizards team down here, I think the Eastern Conference might be just as fun. Like, that would have been a great bracket.
Of course. That wasn't meant to be a statement about the state of the Eastern Conference, even though the Eastern Conference has long been the weaker conference. There are circumstances this time. I'm just saying, because there are circumstances this time, I would have been all in favor of finding a way to tilt this toward the West, having more playoff teams in the East, fewer, because those two, the first round, 1-8, 2-7 in the East is not going to be very enjoyable. A few more before we get you out of here. As long as we're tweaking the league, I just got to say, I don't know where you are on this one. If Jimmy Butler wants to have a blank nameplate on the back of his jersey at a time that you have deviated from decades of tradition and are allowing social justice messages and everything else, just like, I know you didn't bargain it with the Players Association. I know it didn't come up before. It wasn't in the rules. Da, 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 da. I don't care. If Jimmy comes in and says, I'm wearing no name on the back for symbolic reasons, for whatever his reasons are, just let him NBA. Get the lawyers out of stupid stuff like this for once. It's minor. I shouldn't be that worked up about it. But you're allowing the players, in this unique moment in time in this unique moment in our country's history to express themselves in a different way with their jerseys. If that's what Jimmy wanted to do, and it's not running afoul of anything else, it's not messing with corporate sponsorships, it's not messing with logistics of the game, like it's not hurting anything. Like just, you know, or by the way, do this. Let him do it, quietly fine him on the side, but don't force him to change jerseys before the game. Just let him play in the blank jersey. And if you have to fine him for a violation, fine, whatever. He probably wouldn't care either. But this is such a dumb place to draw a line.
I agree. And I think one area where the NBA and the union may have screwed up is not getting the rank and file involved, more involved, I should say, in what can and can't be worn on the backs of jerseys. I think it's important to note, as you know, some of these, you know, conservative Twitter nuts have said, like, the NBA is deciding what you can wear. That's not true. The NBA,
yes,
in collaboration,
yes,
with the union, decided what was what kind of sayings or messages could be on the back of these jerseys. I just think, and it's not just the Butler thing. We've heard several players, whether it's Jaylen Brown in Boston, Mike Scott in Philadelphia, obviously Jimmy Butler now, they would have liked to have done different things and like to have had a stronger voice in that process. Even LeBron James said as much, said he there was some things that he would have wanted to wear on his jersey. I think with the benefit of hindsight, they probably would go back and revisit that and you know, put and do some different things. But I'm with you. Like, Jimmy Butler wants to wear nothing. That's not the hill to die on. Just let him wear nothing. He's not asking to wear something extraordinarily controversial. By the way, nobody's asking to wear something extraordinarily controversial. For all the talk about let players wear what they want, for the most part, the guys I've talked to have mostly lamented not having being able to put their own message about social justice. For like Jason Tatum, he said something recently that he would have wanted to wear the name of Michael Brown, who, as we know, back in Ferguson, was tragically killed by a police officer. So I think if guys have their own ideas, it should be done on a case-by-case basis. Like, don't...
Yeah.
If Jimmy wants to go with a blank one, it's fine. Doesn't hurt anybody. If Jason Tatum wants to wear Michael Brown, great. I think that reminds people of such a horrible tragedy that took place, you know, 6-7 years ago. It's just... I think if they could go back and do it over again, they would have done all that differently.
Yeah, and I really thought before they negotiated all this and settled on the slogans that they did or the word choices that they did, I thought that the most powerful thing would have been if everybody went out there with the names of victims of police violence on their jerseys. And if the WNBA can do it with Breonna Taylor, I don't know why the NBA couldn't have, but that's a line they drew. They decided it wasn't appropriate for whatever reason, or they weren't sure how the families would feel. I mean, I kind of get it, but... That would have been a really, really powerful message too. But I'm not going to quibble overall. Look, you know, the NBA has done an incredible job overall of amplifying this discussion and keeping the attention on it in a variety of ways, symbolically and otherwise, plus the $300 million that they just announced of a pledge to various organizations over the next 10 years. Like, they're in the right place and way ahead of other leagues and a lot of other businesses. So I'm not going to critique them too much over that. But like I say, Jimmy Butler wants a blank jersey, let him have a blank jersey. Before I get you out of here, let's fast forward here. If the Bucks are to be upset before the finals, if they're going to get knocked out, who's it going to be by?
I would say Toronto stands the best chance. I don't think Boston has the front court size to compete with them. It's an ongoing issue for the Celtics. They maintained a top 10 defense, what I thought was through a lot of smoke and mirrors with Daniel Theis and his canter. I think when you face a team with an elite front court, there's only so much you can do in a series like that. And Boston's had a lot of problems with Milwaukee over the years, not just this year and that size. So I don't look at the Celtics as being a threat. Philadelphia, it feels like they're going through the motions out here at this point. I mean, Ben Simmons got hurt in a recent game, and they just haven't played with the type of energy I expect the Sixers to play. The Raptors are just really good. Like, they are really, really good. And, you know, I went to their game against the Magic, and try asking Raptors players about kind of how they're doing this and, you know, how they're able to succeed without Kawhi. And you get these looks back like, what are you talking about? We're really good. And that's really what it comes down to. There's no hidden, like, explanation, no secret to what the Raptors are doing. They just had a bunch of really talented young guys get a lot better this year. You know, Siakam went from most improved to an MVP candidate. Fred VanVleet from very good player to maybe most improved to borderline all-star at this point, the way he's playing. OG Anunoby, who was not part of what the Raptors did last year in the playoffs, he has played well, you know, stepping into that Kawhi role. They still have big, physical front court players like Gasol and Serge Ibaka, so they match up really well with Milwaukee in that round. Now, you certainly can wonder, you know, is Siakam going to be able to do what Kawhi did in the playoffs? Like, can he make the type of shots Kawhi made in the postseason? That's still an open question. Van Vliet, can he continue to make these shots in the postseason? That's a fair question. But on paper, the Raptors match up really well. And, you know, 1 to like 9 on that team, they are almost great defensively. They get into you. They take pride in it. They can stop you in whether it's being physical or with the finesse game. I mean, they're just, as improbable as it sounds, like, you make a list of the championship favorites, the Raptors can't be any lower than, like, fourth on that list at this point. I mean, it's impossible to look at it any other way.
Second best defense in the East, probable coach of the year in Nick Nurse. They get the most out of all these young guys, the fringe guys, the second rounders, the undrafted guy, like, everybody you just named. They've done nothing but exceed expectations at every turn. Like, underestimating them at this point seems ridiculous. And I know, like, this is unprecedented to have a team win a championship and have the MVP just walk away. But I feel like, and I hate getting to the, you know, this team's disrespected, all that crap. But, like, I feel like the Raptors, like, have, like, the least amount of respect for a defending champion in recent memory, not counting, you know, a team that was completely torn down, like, you know, whatever. Well, actually, you know, even when LeBron walked away from the Heat, like, they had lost in the finals. And when he walked away from the Cavs, they had lost in the finals. But a team that's the defending champion, to have this little regard for them, I think it's a combination of underestimating them, and I do think people overestimate the Bucks just a little bit.
And look, the Raptors, like, two quick things about them. They are an incredibly high IQ team. Like, there are a lot of smart players out there on the floor that don't beat themselves. And when I talk to people in the Raptors organization, the one thing I hear repeatedly is that Kawhi's gone, but Kawhi's still here. Like, Kawhi has rubbed off on these guys, and that will impact them in this postseason. Like, before, when we saw this Raptor team lose to Cleveland and Miami and whatever team LeBron was on at any point over the years, like, they didn't have the mental toughness. When they got beat in one or two games, they got down on themselves. Put it another way, if they didn't have Kawhi in the conference finals last year going down 0-2, they don't win that series. Like, and that's not just because of Kawhi's talent. It's because Kawhi is, like, the king of shrugging off a loss and moving on to the next one. All that has rubbed off on this Raptor team. So, you know, Kawhi's, you know, shadow or image still lingers with this team. That's going to be really helpful for them in the playoffs. You know, and you mentioned Nick Nurse, to add one more thing. Like, did you make anything out of it that Nick Nurse didn't win the Coach of the Year vote by the coaches? Because I don't know about you, but I think he's going to win Coach of the Year in the media vote by a landslide.
Yes.
Like, I voted for him.
I
know
did
a lot
too.
Of people. Yeah, I think he's going to win, you know, by a wide margin. And no disrespect to Billy Donovan, who was on my Coach of the Year ballot. Mike Budenholzer was excellent as well. But I thought it was interesting that Nick Nurse doesn't get the same props from his peers that he's going to get from the media.
I don't know what to make of it, Chris. This happens sometimes, and yes, like, it's starting to get confusing, right? Because the players do their own awards, and those usually, like, people barely pay attention because of when they come out. But the National Basketball Coaches Association now doing this Coach of the Year thing, which preempts ours that the media votes on, it's fascinating because, like the Executive of the Year award, that's voted on by executives, not by the media. We have no voice in that one whatsoever, which is fine. But the Executives of the Year pick their own Executive of the Year, which does sometimes, I think, reflect a little bit of how they feel about each other. You can say the same for the coaches. I do think it's curious. I agree with you. I think Nurse is going to be, I don't know if it's a landslide. I think, like, the typical year, we've got between 6 and 9 coaches, I think, who were legitimate to put on the ballot somewhere. I think I went Nurse, Spoelstra, Carlisle. But Donovan was somebody I heavily considered, and you know, Mike Malone was somebody I considered. There's a bunch of guys I considered, and it's a you know, competitive field as usual. I don't know what to make of that. It's not like Nick Nurse is some polarizing figure in the coaching community.
I think he's a little polarizing. I do.
How so?
I think that he is. Well, I think he's gotten a lot of positive attention.
Sure.
Early on, and deservedly so. I mean, his schemes have been excellent. It's not like he's just out there rolling the balls out. Like, he has an integral part of this team's success, but he has gotten a lot of positive attention early on. It kind of reminds me a little bit of what was the year that Dwayne Casey swept the coaching vote and Brad Stevens didn't get like any votes or got like one vote, something like that.
Yes. I was trying to remember the other one that had come up, and it was that one, and that was a similar thing, right?
It feels a little the same there, where, yeah. You know, Brad Stevens was kind of a newcomer on the scene just a few years in and was getting a lot of attention. Nick Nurse, I feel like, is getting the same attention. But, I mean, you know, he's a top-year coaching ballot. He's a top mind, but I think there's enough ambiguity with the rest of the spots. Like, I didn't vote for the guys you mentioned. My ballot went Nurse, Vogel, and then Billy Donovan. I give Vogel a lot of credit for what he did with the Lakers.
Considered him as well. Sure.
Yeah, so I think there'll be a lot of votes for that second and third place. I just think Nick Nurse is going to wind up getting a vast majority of the top ones.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder how many years in a row we can do this where the coach of the year thing will be split, where the media and the coaches come up with completely different answers. But
he's an incredible coach, man. Like, I had this conversation with Marc Gasol just last night where, you know, Mark had said something during the media Zoom call about, you know, we've got the best coaching staff in the league. And I was like, Mark, what does that mean? He's like, it's a combination of things. Like, our prep is unreal. Like, we go into games, you know, so unbelievably prepared for what our opponents are going to do. But there's a combination of it that Nick also gives them a lot of freedom to do what they want to do on the floor. If they see something, he's not so rigid that he holds them to his schemes or what he's desiring to do. So it took him a while to become an NBA head coach, but I mean, he's clearly, to me, elite, and I think undoubtedly the coach of the year.
And when the players are swearing by him in the way that they are, and especially a guy like Marc Gasol, who's been around, who's been an all-star, who's a really, you know, smart player and a guy who's always prepared himself and knows how to evaluate what he's seeing, like, that, you know, that goes a long way. That's meaningful.
By the way, shout out to Marc Gasol, who like answered a question I asked during the Zoom call and then got up and walked over to me and said, I hope I answered your question right. Do you need me to help you anymore? Like, shout out to Marc Gasol for being that kind of guy and helping out, making sure we got the right answer.
No, that's awesome. I did a feature on him, like, I don't know, 5 years ago or whatever, back in Memphis, and they had set us up in some little side room at the arena. Hey, you know, here's a couple couches, whatever, take it, you know, and it was supposed to be like 30 minutes or whatever. 30 minutes comes, we're still talking. Mark, being as just, you know, as expansive as he is going. He's telling all these stories. He's been great. And the PR person, like, opened the door, you know, a little bit to see what was going on. And, like, Mark just, like, waved him off. Like, you know, get out of here. We're good. We went over an hour. It was supposed to be for, you know, 25, 30 minutes or something. So, yeah.
That's why I don't understand sometimes, like, even being down here, there are guys that, like, cringe at doing, like, a 10-minute Zoom interview. Like, come on. Like, if that's... like, what are we keeping you from? Like, Call of Duty in your room? Like, there's not, like, and if you engage on this stuff, more often than not, like, something good for you comes out of it. Like, more often than not, you get a more constructive, deeper, and oftentimes positive story out of it. I never understand why more guys aren't like a Marc Gasol and several, and many other players that we've covered
sure. In
the league that are as accommodating, as accessible as they are.
Yeah, no question. Chris, this has been great, man. I will let you get back to bubble life, swabs up your nose, whatever.
Ooh, that reminds me, got to go get the daily test, fill out the daily, I got my app here to fill out the temperature checks, and
nice.
Gotta get my pulse ox done as well. It's weird, man. Like, the just to leave your room is a process in and of itself.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a blast, really.
At least it's not the brain tickler.
Oh, the one that goes so far up your nose that it, like, actually, like, jams you in the skull.
I don't think I could do that for 45 days. I don't think I could do it.
Yeah, that's cruel and unusual punishment. This has been great, man. Be safe down there. Have fun. Talk soon.
You got it.